Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Alexander Hogue Gallery at the University of Tulsa is hosting a new exhibition by master printmaker Tom Huck. Huck's work can best be described as a cross between the work of the Renaissance master Albrecht Dürer and underground comics. His large-scale satirical works are intricately created with many of the elements of Renaissance printmakers, very, very busy background, but with subject matter of grotesque figures and often raunchy subject matter. The St. Louis-based printer is the principal of Evil Prints and is associated with a group of contemporary printmakers known as the Outlaw Printmakers. His woodcut prints, some of which take years to create, are in the collections of the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York, the Nelson Atkins in Kansas City, the Fogg Museum at Harvard, and the New York Public Library, to name just a few. For this exhibit, titled Adventures in Absurdity, there's a mixture of his large-scale as well as smaller work, including several prints from his large Booger Stew Cycles, as well as another series titled The Hillbilly Kama Sutra, which is aptly named, as well as small-scale works, Bugs, and a Monster Set. Huck is a visiting artist at the University of Tulsa's School of Art and will be giving a lecture this afternoon at 5 o'clock at Phillips Hall with a reception to follow in the gallery. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Tom Huck, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And it's great to see your work on display at the Hogue Gallery. You've been running Evil Prints for a number of years. 20 years now. Your influence, you can see it in other people's work, but certainly your work is everywhere out there. And this show features a lot of what we come to think of as Tom Huck's, from these huge prints that harken back to sort of that apocalyptic era of the Renaissance where, you
Albert know, Dürer and of that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. How big an influence is that on your work?
Well, specifically Albert Dürer, who's my ultimate hero. I've been influenced by a lot of different art and different music, but he's probably ground zero for me in terms of inspiration, because I discovered his work when I was 13 years old, and I laugh when I tell people that, like, I still am a metalhead. You know, I listen to Iron Maiden and Motorhead and Judas Priest and all that stuff. But when you're 13 and you find the work of Albrecht Dürer, any one of those prints could have been an album cover for Iron Maiden, any of my favorite metal bands. And so in a weird way, I found a way to stay 13 years old for my entire life, creative life. And I have an excuse. I got art history to back it up. So, you know, he's the most important influence on me because of the technical complexity and accomplishment of the prints. He was a great distributor and businessman around the printed image and the dark and lurid subject matter. And all of print history is littered with dark and lurid subject matter and social commentary and criticism, because you can make copies. And anytime you can make copies of something, it's a natural thing to spout off about things. So I loved that history of it. And so I've been into prints since I was 13 years old.
And, you know, Dürer, it didn't matter if it was lurid material or
religious
subversive material or very religious, mm-hmm. like sort of into the world mm-hmm. sort of religious material. Even if it was a simple subject, there was always this density to it of lines. And that comes across in your work, because most of your images are chock full of...
There's a lot of stuff going on in there.
Yeah.
Well, I want to be an entertainer mm-hmm. with my work, and I want people to find new things all the time in my work. That's what I get when I look at a Bosch painting. I'm always coming back and finding some lurid detail that adds to the overall narrative that still not anyone really knows what Bosch was trying to say, but there's a lot for your imagination in there, coming from a great imagination. And I want to do that in my work. I want to scare people off, but lure them back in, kind of peeking around the corner after they've already been shocked and they come back to it in some way.
And what I love is there's this really interesting 60s, 70s sensibility to your figures.
That's because of Robert Crumb.
Yeah.
I'm a huge Robert Crumb fan. I know him a little bit, and I got to spend some time with him over the years a little. And every year at Christmas time, from the time I was about 14, instead of writing to Santa Claus, I wrote R. Crumb a letter. My parents would pay for the postage on that. And he never wrote me back. And then I met him about 10 years ago, and I asked him, did you get my letters? And He was like, yeah, I got him. I said, why didn't you write me back? You know, and he was like, oh, it was a wild period. I was like, you know, and he, you know, and he, that whole very subversive, technically brilliant draftsman, funny, historically based in that he's a big Rowlandson, Cruikshank, Hogarth fan, and Bruegel. Mm-hmm. I have the same influences. He fits into that graphic history, social commentary, and criticism perfectly, along with all the printmakers.
But what I love about your work is that 60s, 70s sort of grotesque figures.
Well, there's like Rick Griffin, yeah. The art concert posters, yeah. That sort of stuff. The psychedelic, a little bit of that in there. And a lot of that comes from looking at album covers and things like that as well from that time period, because I'm a big fan of music since the 50s. You know, so there's some of that in there too. Yeah,
but I love the fact that it's like that melded with Bosch and, mm-hmm. and Durer, where you have, you know, these ribbonic elements that are going through, whether it could be snakes mm-hmm. Or dogs with elongated tongues.
Right. I'm always looking for what kind of a gesture or an appendage I can use as a directional tool compositionally to help guide your eye around. Mm-hmm. And there's all kinds of things. Snakes are good for that. Tongues are good for that. You know, all kinds of things.
Now, I was looking. Some are lithographs, but others look like they're woodcuts.
All of my stuff. About 90% of what I do is woodcuts. Yeah.
Woodcuts.
Yeah. Lithographs, I do those every once in a while when I go to a shop that does lithography. Mm-hmm. So I'm working with a master printer on those who is a litho expert. And I know how to do it. I could teach it at one time, but to do my own, to print my own work, I need somebody that really knows. But I self-publish everything else.
And so the woodcuts you do yourself?
Those are done and printed in my own shop, Evil Prints in St. Louis.
Yeah. And when you look at something like Tent Revival Blues or, mm-hmm. or The Transformation of Brandy Baghead, which is mm-hmm. a triptych, which we'll talk about in a moment. I mean, this is like every inch of the this huge, large image has cuts.
Har vacui. That's what they call it, I think. But, it's a control thing, I think. Mm-hmm. It's the way these things look in my head. If that makes any sense, I have a lot of information that I want to get out about the subject that I'm trying to portray. And subtlety is not one of my better artistic traits. Restraint isn't one that I use a lot. And it's an apocalyptic world, man, that we live in now. And I don't mean to get religious-like on it, but it's pretty bad out there. And there's a lot of bad stuff going on. And so there's a lot of bad stuff in my prints going on.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about The Transformation of Brandy Baghead. Triptych, huge print. What is it, about?
13 foot by 8 foot, 9 right. foot, somewhere there. The Transformation of Brandy Baghead, it took about 4.5 years to do. And that's like 6-7 hours a day, every day, regular work wow. weeks. I mean, these things are, they take a long time. This is what I do for a living. So I go to the studio every day and I'm working on an inch of carving that
day.
Is
that a good day?
Yeah, it's a good day.
An inch?
Inch and a half, probably. And The Transformation of Brandy Baghead is about a woman who's having herself turned into a chicken to enter a reality TV show ice skating contest. And that's where we are at, folks, as a society, culturally. That's where we are. And one of my big heroes is Hogarth, who is a great English satirist printmaker. And I want to be the mirror to society for our time through the print medium. And that is what and where my work really falls into. And The Transformation of Brandy Baghead, it falls right into that, hey, this is what I'm about. I think with that print, I stopped making the art about hillbillies doing bad stuff in southern Missouri, where I'm from, and it became a more broader-based social commentary. And I was hanging out on the couch with my pregnant wife watching reality television, and there was this show called The Swan that came on. I can't remember what network. Maybe it was Fox or something. I don't remember.
Okay.
But this
is about taking a woman and basically
giving them tons of plastics. They put him in an ugly audition.
Yeah.
It was the worst thing I've ever seen. And I told myself, this can't last more than a season. And they didn't bring it back. And I thought, I'm doing something about this. And so instead of, you know, the premise of the show is from an ugly duckling to a swan. And then they put all these women after 20 straight hours of plastic surgery in a beauty pageant at the end of it, and they all look like the same porn star. And it was so frightening. It was, and some of this stuff you can't top in
you
art.
You can't make it up.
And, you know, I get asked a lot, where do your ideas come from? And are you ever going to run out of ideas? There's always some craziness just around the corner that we don't know what's going to happen yet. And so Brandy Baghead was the first time I really got to a bigger cultural commentary, you know, and that's sort of, there's always some hillbillydom in there somewhere, but I'm leaning more towards that in my work now. I mean, after 20 years of doing this, you know, I've seen a lot of stuff now. I watch our culture. I'm a news junkie.
And that triptych, the beta carotene queen.
That's the first panel of Brandy Baghead.
And then America's Next Top Omelet, which gets into this chicken idea.
Yeah,
but it's also, when you look at it, it's like it's the process of that swan
the hatch.
Process.
Yeah, right. I did that whole burrito of coming of age fake physically, if that's the best way to put it. And then the third panel is Skating with the Scars instead of Skating with the Stars, which is a play on that TV show. I took that third image directly. It's actually Michelle Kwan off of her Wheaties box. And I needed a skater, you know, and so I took that. I was like, well, that's the pose I want, you know. The
Don't show that to Michelle.
No. It doesn't look like her at all. It's just the pose, you know. I get that stuff from a lot of – my stuff comes from a lot of visual places out there.
Well, and that's very apparent is that there's a lot of television imagery. There's a lot of pop culture imagery. But you have transformed that imagery into this very grotesque world. And that seems to be – there is a Tom Huck world, and it's not a nice place.
It's not a nice place. The trick to that is you got to make that stuff beautiful. That's part of my thing. It's like Tarantino does. You know, he takes horrible things and films them really beautifully. Well, I want to take this horrible stuff that we are and do them in a beautiful way, in a way enhancing the horrifying quality of it through that. And that's what a lot of artists and printmakers especially that I love do through craft. Dewar, you know, the Apocalypse series, there's horrible things going on in that, but they're absolutely gorgeously done. And that's what got me drawn into printmaking. And so that's what I try to do. And that's sort of, it's not a shtick, it's an approach, an aesthetic approach and a technical approach to luring an audience in. Because these days, there's a lot to compete with out there. And another thing that I was talking to students here at the school, these things don't look really good on someone's phone or on Instagram. You have to go see these things in real life. So, you know, I'm not working of the times at all. I'm taking medieval
techniques
and trying to make them contemporary and relevant to today. It's not an easy thing to do, but you know, a lot of people ask me, well, why do you keep doing this? You could go, you could get an iPad or a print. You could work using technology. I want to be as good as my heroes were, so I have to be able to do what they did.
Yeah. Well, and you're talking about a piece like some of the large pieces where if you get about an inch and a half or 2 inches square done a day, that's a good day.
That is a good day. I was so frustrated before I got on the plane and came out here. I went into the studio at like 6 a.m. and my flight left at noon, and I was just desperately trying to get my quota of carving done for the day because I'm on a project right now. I have an April deadline on one of the blocks, and I didn't make it quite what I wanted. And it's just, it hangs over me. These things are very physical to make. They're mentally draining, and you spend 4 years on something. I do small stuff too along the way to keep myself relatively sane, but those big ones that I do, are big prints, are huge undertakings.
Is woodcut forgiving as far as, like, you know, if
you
the hand
slips? You
can't
make a mistake.
Cannot make a mistake.
I think about every cut that I make in the block before I make it. It's very slow.
So it's almost like you're measuring twice, a cut once, right?
Yeah, it really is like that. And it's living life by the inch. My creative life is lived by the inch. You know, the other part of that, what keeps me going, I like to talk a lot about history. And every day that I go into the studio, I think about how in the world am I going to make prints that were as good as my heroes made, like Dewar and Posada and Goya and all those people. And I take it very seriously. And if I don't, then I'm a failure because I know what I'm capable of. And these people, Dewar and all those guys, they're like members of my family. I feel like I know those artists spiritually across the hundreds of years, and I want to be part of that history, so I take it very seriously. So that keeps me going in the end, and it's about a 50 and 60-year body of work that I'm working toward, you know? And so I kind of am okay with living in the inch that day, knowing that I'm going to leave something behind.
And that inch is the best you can make it.
Right? Yeah, and it's very harrowing.
And I tell you what, it's very clear when you look at the prints. And I really recommend folks come out to see Adventures in Absurdity because you can see the precision of a, say, 5-6 foot high print that's maybe 30 inches wide.
And then we have to print them. Yeah. After, you know, printing big prints like that is not an easy thing to do.
And it's just so clean. It looks like it could look like it's an ink drawing. You know,
they start as that.
Certainly.
And yeah. I have to do the drawing twice.
Yeah.
Because when you cut it out, you're drawing it again in a way. And also it all has to be backwards. Mm-hmm. So I draw them backwards. I can write full sentences backwards now. It's not a big deal. I can write everything backwards. You just start to think that way when you're a printmaker.
My guest today is printmaker Tom Huck. He is the man behind Evil Prints, and his work is on display at the Alexander Hogue Gallery on the University of Tulsa campus. Adventures in Absurdity, on display through February 18th, and it shows off his great skills. And as we mentioned, there's some large pieces like the Transformation of Brandy Baghead. There is also, I believe, Tommy Peepers.
Tommy Peepers is the latest big.
What was the inspiration for this?
Okay, I'll keep this as clean as possible.
Okay, yeah, please do.
It's... I don't know what this says about me 30 years later making art about this, but it's all about the first time that I saw breasts other than my mother's on June 15th, 1983 at 2:30 in the afternoon at the Potosi City Pool. I'm from a small town called Potosi, Missouri, and 30 years later I made a piece about Stephanie Harrelson. That's her name. And she totally gave me permission to do this. She was the lifeguard at the pool. And she dove off, and I was underwater, and I saw her top come down for a half of a second, and I was in fourth grade. She was a senior in high school, and I never got over it.
Now, as you mentioned, we've probably mentioned, if you're easily offended, there is a section of the show.
Are you going to say it?
I'm just going to refer to it as the Hillbilly Kama Sutra.
Even I hear somebody say that, and I'm almost embarrassed about it. But kind of not. I did that set of prints, the Hillbilly Kama Sutra, as a joke. I was going crazy working on the Tommy Peepers, and there was this editor named Monty Beauchamp. He's a good friend of mine. He does an underground sort of publication of underground sort of art called Blab out of Chicago, and he was bothering me in a very good way and endearing way to come up with some new pages for him. And I couldn't come up with any ideas. I was so heavily in the early planning of the Tommy Peepers. And he kept calling me. And we almost got in a fight over the phone. And he was like, "You got to give me something." I was like, "Okay, Mont. Well, I'll just do the Hillbilly Kama Sutra. How would you like that?" And there was this long pause after. He was like, "Oh, my God, Huck, you have to do that." And I was like, "No." And then I started doing it. And it was total self-indulgent at first, and then it got to be a drag. After about the three or four away from a whole set of 15, it took 2 years to do it. I was like, I got to go into the studio today and come up with another hillbilly sex scene or something. I was just like, I can't do this anymore. I was so glad that set was done, and I thought, I'm never going to sell any of these. No one's ever going to want to hang these. And I sold all of them to museums. Almost all museums bought them right away. They aren't hanging them, but I sold all of them. I couldn't believe it.
What do you think it was about it that the museum?
I think people thought it was funny.
Well, they are funny.
They're funny, and you just don't see people doing that in art now, where it's total. It's very sort of raunchy. It's very Dance of Death, like Holbein's Dance of Death. They're very inspired by that. So there's, I think one of the things that makes my work appealing to museums or whatever, there's a strong art historical reference to it. Right. So I can kind of get away with some things. All this stuff has already been done in the Middle Ages, you know, and that stuff hangs in museums.
Heck, it's been done in Pompeii.
Been done, all that stuff. Yeah. The whole idea behind the Hillbilly Kama Sutra is that every, in the Dance of Death, everyone's going to die no matter what, whether you're rich, poor, whatever, you're going to die. Well, in mine, everybody has sex. That's just the way it is. And I don't like how it's such a puritanical, guilt-ridden thing in this country. And so that's kind of why I did that, I guess, in the overall inspiration.
And I would call them raunchy. You use the word raunchy, and I think raunchy is the best word.
It is.
Obscene. You know, it's not obscene.
Right.
It's raunchy.
Right.
But some of the other things I was really struck by was this really interesting comment on religion, the tent revival blues.
Well, that image is from a set of prints I did called The Bloody Bucket, and it was all about this bar culture in a small town, southern Missouri. There was a bar called The Bloody Bucket. There are a few of them that have existed around, and this one particularly was frequented by World War II veterans coming home and just doing crazy stuff in the late 40s and early 50s. And my dad heard all these stories. My dad, he's still alive, but he was the town chiropractor. He was a small town doctor. My whole family they're all chiropractors. So you see a lot of bones and stuff in my work. But people would tell him all these stories. And so I would hear these stories growing up. And a few of the prints that are in The Bloody Bucket are direct stories. And a few, like Tent Revival Blues, is more about the culture that surrounds the bar, the people, the hunters, and how they worship. It's like a worshiping sort of thing. Deer hunting is a
right.
ritual.
Right.
It's a tribal rite. And so that's what that's about. And it's like a deer exorcism in a church or something like that. You know, so
with a cardinal complete,
yeah.
with a little
I throw
funny
the Catholicism
hat.
In on top of there too, because the Catholics have the best outfits. I'm Catholic. We have the best outfits, guys. We just do. I love the pomp and circumstance of it. And I put a lot of that imagery in the work too, because it's immediately going to get a reaction out of someone. They'll think it's a religious image, and then it makes them think. It lures them in, and it really isn't a religious image.
Now, see, I thought the deer on the cross.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
There's a cross there.
Yeah, yeah, that's a statement. That's like a little underhanded statement, because I'm really kind of root for the deer. You know, it's like if you go, you know, bullfighters. I always find myself in movies where rooting for the animals. Yeah. I really do. I'm not like a PETA person or whatever, but I kind of want them to have their day every once in a while. But this is a commentary. That one specifically is about
the rituals around hunting. Yeah, where you blood the face afterwards.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I've seen deer dressings.
Yep.
You know, if anyone has never seen that, the way that they splay them up and hang them up, it's like a crucifixion. And so I make those leaps all the time in my work. I do. I have to. I call it a visual and narrative leap. When I used to teach, that's what I would try to get students to do that wanted to work in a narrative way. It's called a visual and a narrative leap, taking separate elements narratively and combining them to make one overall arching statement, a visual hook, if you were. That's sort of where I reside with that. And Tent Revival Blues is a good example of that with the crucified deer.
Yeah. One of the things I found really interesting is you experiment with different papers. Like there's one.
The Tommy Peepers is on tea stained paper.
Yeah, no, that's really dark.
The thing about that too is now I find myself trying to make my prints look like they're from the 1400s physically. I want them to look old. And I've moved kind of into, if you notice, the border on that is a doily-style border. That's all hand-cut out. It's sort of making the prints objects as well as, you know, a window into another reality. It's a triptych, and there's a strong art historical and religious, you know, reference with triptychs because they're mm-hmm. devotional altarpiece objects.
Right.
So there's that, too. So I'm really wanting the prints to become objects that exist in our world, not just as pictures.
Yeah, I think on one of those ones with the doily cutout, I was thinking, has he decaled something? How has he done that? And I realized, oh, that's the edge of the paper.
And it's hand cut out by my horribly abused assistants in my shop who had to sit there, and we had to cut out 25 of those each.
Wow.
You know, it takes a long time. It took probably 6 months to cut all of those out. By hand. Everything has to be done by hand in the slow way.
Now you contrast that with some of the small pieces that are in the show. Like there's a cards, the bugs.
Yeah.
And I assume those are sort of like the relief valves for when you're working on one of these.
That is totally true. They serve two functions. I do, you know, my shop is called Evil Prince. It's a storefront in downtown St. Louis. And that's something that I sort of evolved into. The selling of my own work. I have galleries out there that handle my work, but I sell a lot of my stuff myself because I make a living at this. You know, to really make a living at selling prints, which are cheaper, you have to have probably 100 galleries. Well, I don't have 100 galleries to actually make a living, so I sell the stuff myself too. And over time, I had to come up with some cheaper stuff.
Sure.
For everybody, because yeah. I would go to art fairs. Like, I'm not talking about your city arts district art fair. I'm talking about, like, print fairs in New York and L.A. and
big
high-end, big-time print yeah. publishing shows where people would come on Sunday and kids would come by with their parents. They come on the free day, which is great, and the kids love my stuff.
Right.
But mom isn't going to throw down $4,000 for a Tommy Peepers, especially a Tommy Peepers. And so I thought, well, you know, all my heroes over the years, they had affordable prints for everybody too. And I've got all price ranges now. So the bugs that you see over there in the gallery and the War Wigglers, those are $10 and $15 prints.
So the War Wigglers are...
They're like the monster heads.
Yeah, the little monster heads.
The monster
yeah.
heads. Those are $10 and $15. Very affordable. We can put those on t-shirts, sell them out of my shop, and sell them in package deals with the print. And I have every price range from $10 all the way up to $16,000. And I believe in that. I believe it should be affordable for everybody. You know,
when you look at some of the revolutions that are happening in the arts today, I see it especially in music, where a lot of times, you know, artists are now they're their own music publishing, their mm-hmm. own recording and making their own recordings and selling them themselves. You think the same thing's going to start happening in the art world? I mean, the art world, the gallery system is really heavily entrenched.
The gallery system is a very confusing place. I'm very fortunate. You know, I've been able since when I was like, I made my first museum sale when I was 24, but I sold it myself. And I think printmaking has always been that way. There have always been self-publishers. So we've always done it the punk rock way,
right.
DIY.
Yeah.
And I think it's out there. There's more power in your hand. I think it could be a bad thing and a good thing. Not everybody's a genius.
Right. The curatorial
and
process
everybody
is important. Yeah.
Has a YouTube channel now. Everybody has a Facebook page. Everybody has an Instagram. And everybody's a genius. That's just not true. That's done some – there isn't as much of a filter as the curatorial and the galleries used to do, which I think is a bad thing. But on the other hand, the good stuff always comes through.
Yeah.
It may just take a little bit longer because there's more – junk out there to sift through.
Tom, thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Contemporary printmaker Tom Huck speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He is the principal behind his press, Evil Prints. You can see an exhibit of his work titled Adventures in Absurdity at the Alexander Hogue Gallery at the University of Tulsa through February 18th. He's also a visiting artist at the university and will be giving a lecture this afternoon at 5 o'clock at Phillips Hall with a reception to follow. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.